I'm going to get started now. I'm going to call to order this Wednesday, December 3rd meeting of the Government Accountability and Information Technology Committee. And thank you for being here. I want to remind people, please turn off your cell phones and Blackberries and like. So we're going to open with an informational meeting. We have, as you can see, three members here, and Representative Richardson is on the phone. So we're going to go ahead and open the informational meeting on the Medical Management Information System update. And if you gentlemen would come forward, I'd appreciate it. We've got Jim Joyce and Clyde Saiki.
Saiki. That's great.
So go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Okay. Chair Riley and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Saiki. I'm the Deputy Director for Operations for the Department of Human Services. And with me at the table is Jim Joyce, who is the Project Manager for our Medicaid Management Information System Replacement Project. So we're here this morning to provide you with information on the implementation of our new Medicaid Management Information System, or as we call it, MMIS. The new MMIS system is scheduled to go live on December 6th for pharmacy claims, and then will go live on December 9th for all other Medicaid payments. The current system is over 25 years old and is based on old mainframe and COBOL technology. In addition to being based in outdated technology, it was also designed for a fee-for-service payment system, which is different from our current managed care environment. This means that changes to the system to accommodate policy and program changes are costly and time-consuming. This is a very large and complex system. The current system, which was implemented in 1980, was designed to handle about 260,000 claims a month. Currently, we're processing an average of about 2 million claims a month for over 35,000 providers throughout the state that deliver healthcare services to our 430,000 clients. During the course of a year, the system will process approximately $2 billion worth of payments. At this time, I will turn the presentation over. If there are no questions, I'll turn the presentation over to Mr. Joyce, and he'll give you more information on the implementation of the new system.
I never thought I'd have James Joyce in front of my committee. Go ahead.
Good morning. My presentation is going to cover the work that we've done over the last 3 years to prepare to implement the new system, and the work that we've done to prepare Medicaid providers, clients, and users in the new system. They'll be getting a new system plus new business processes to support the Medicaid program. We've provided you a one-page front and back handout which summarizes the Medicaid Management Information System facts about the project and the facts about what we're doing to transition the program. We ask that you use this as a reference in working with stakeholders that may contact you as it relates to issues that we're expecting to manage through the transition. In my presentation, I want to tell you a little bit more about what is a MMIS, some facts about the project, including some benefits that we expect to accrue as a result of the project, and then what we've done to prepare providers, users, and clients for the new system, and then finally what DHS has done to prepare for the transition to a new system. As Mr. Saiki mentioned, the MMIS is a very large and complex system. The system is mandated by the federal government to administer the spending of federal and state funds for the Medicaid program. As Mr. Saiki mentioned, we spend nearly $2 billion a year on Medicaid funds. So it's a very large system making payments to providers throughout the state. But the MMIS is more than a claims processing system. The system is an extensive benefits administration system. It handles the enrollment of providers and the credentialing of providers. It handles it handles providers being to verify eligibility of clients for the Medicaid program. It manages the contracts with providers. It makes payments for pharmacy, fee-for-service, and managed care. It handles all the Medicaid financial transactions, including interfaces with the state financial management system. It handles the intake of paper claims, turning them into electronic claims and feeding them into the system. And it provides a decision support data warehouse, which allows the department to analyze Medicaid information and make better decisions going forward. And finally, it provides the ability to generate the myriad of federal and state reporting that is required for the Medicaid program. Now, as I mentioned, Medicaid is the basic funding mechanism that supports services throughout DHS, and the MMIS is the means by which those Medicaid payments are being made. So it's an essential part of what we do in DHS. Next, let me give you some facts about the MMIS replacement project. The project began in 2001. The construction and implementation phase began in 2005. We contracted with EDS, Electronic Data Systems, which is now a HP subsidiary. We contracted with EDS to transfer the Oklahoma MMIS, which is in production there. We asked them then to modify it to meet the Medicaid requirements in Oregon. And so what we've been working on the last 3 years is to make those modifications and to test those modifications with the business experts within Oregon and to work with the providers to make sure that the system is going to work. The project budget is approximately $80 million, of which approximately 90% is federally funded. After the implementation, EDS will support the computer system while DHS actually operates the system to administer the Medicaid program. EDS already supports MMIS systems in about 22 other states, so their expertise on this project has been invaluable. The three major benefits that we hope to achieve, that we expect to achieve with this system, I'm going to talk about those next. And those are in addition to replacing the outdated technology and the current costly system. Those three major benefits are, one, being able to release new medical ID cards for Medicaid clients. Starting in January, Oregon Medicaid clients will receive new medical ID cards, which are pretty much like the industry standard. When a Medicaid client goes for services, they'll present the card as a means to identify that the provider needs to validate that that client is eligible for services. The providers then will do that, and if they are eligible, they'll administer the services. That's a fairly major change. Currently, Medicaid clients receive a 8.5 by 11 client notice, which has their guaranteed eligibility on the notice, and they receive these notices on a monthly basis. And when they present those to providers, that's a guarantee of service. Now, the disadvantage of doing that is that we have month-by-month eligibility versus dynamic eligibility, which changes during the month. And so this is a major step forward with the system being able to dynamically manage eligibility and pay for it more accurately. The second major benefit is that we'll be providing a provider web portal. And this is a direct link that providers will have with the MMIS. Starting this month, they'll be able to access that system to validate eligibility of Medicaid clients. Starting in March, they'll be able to submit claims, watch them adjudicate real time, and then if there's errors with their claims, make changes to those claims and resubmit them dynamically. We believe that the web portal will be one of the mechanisms by which providers will get paid much faster. The system as a whole is set up such that we can provide more accurate and more timely payments to providers, and that's the third major benefit that we expect from the system. Next, let me tell you a little bit about what we're doing to prepare providers, clients, and users for the new system. Over the last 8 months, we've done extensive user testing. We've parallel tested our existing claims through the new system and have validated that they'll pay correctly. And we've tested with our major electronic submitters, including our pharmacy providers, and that looks good. In order to prepare providers for the transition, we've released 11 information releases. We set up a provider website which has all the documentation that they need for the transition. We've conducted 111 provider training sessions. In fact, this morning I introduced one here in Salem in 49 different locations, and we've trained over 4,000 providers on how to work in the new system. We've also established an online e-course which allows providers to go online and be trained on their own time in a self-study mode. And we've had hundreds of providers take advantage of that capability. And then starting in January, we'll have extensive follow-on provider training for those that were not able to sign up or not able to attend in the last 6 months. Now, to prepare MMIS users, we've done many of the same things. We've had extensive communications. We've conducted over 730 classroom sessions in 19 different locations in the state. We've trained nearly 4,000 users through that process. We also have an online e-course which teaches the fundamentals of the course, and we've had nearly 3,000 users take that online course. In addition to that, we've conducted an extensive change management business transition because within DHS we're changing many of the business processes because of the advanced features of the system. And in January we expect to do follow-on training with those users that need refresher training or need additional training as it relates to what they find out they don't know when we go live. Now, to prepare clients for the usage of the new Medicaid ID card, we've communicated them with direct communications via mail to make them aware of what's coming. And we've trained the providers on what to do when they bring the new Medicaid ID card in. Next, let me tell you a little about what we're doing within the department to manage the transition. These, from looking at what's occurred in other states, and in the last year, four other states have gone through a MMIS transition. So we've been able to observe what works and what doesn't work in other states. We've learned from those lessons, and we've done some work to prepare for what's going to occur in Oregon. What we can expect is that providers and clients are going to need assistance in the transition. We can expect that providers are going to be concerned about their payments, whether they're timely and whether they're accurate. And when their payments get denied, they're going to be concerned about understanding the error codes, the new error codes in the system that they're going to have to understand in order to modify the claims, adjust the claims, and resubmit them. And we also understand that with the new Medicaid ID card process, some clients are going to be confused about the change and will need some assistance. So this is what we've done. We've done three major things. The first is that we've doubled our capacity in our provider and client call centers. We've doubled the capacity. We've done extensive training with the call center agents to prepare them to assist providers and clients in making the transition. We've done extensive education training, but we still expect that a large number of providers and clients are going to need dynamic assistance on the spot when they realize that they should have gone to the training, they should have read the notice that was sent to them. We realize that we're going to need to assist them through the transition. The second major thing that the department has done is that we've prepared to make transition payments for providers that are affected by the transition. And let me tell you about two of those provisions. One is for nursing facilities. 100 of 130 nursing facilities have applied for and have been granted expedited payments. That is, that they will receive expedited payments for the November services this week. Otherwise, what would have occurred is that their payment cycle would have been interrupted by approximately a week. So in order to avoid that payment cycle and the flow of finances to the nursing facilities, we're expediting their payments this week. For all providers, we're providing a transition payment program that allows them, if they are affected, namely their claims are withheld, their payments are somehow withheld, they can apply to get a transition payment until those claims are paid through the natural process. The transition program allows for them to be paid up to 80% of their historical payment amount, and we track that pretty closely on a weekly basis. And then when their payments do go through, we'll work to recoup any difference between what's been paid and what they were owed. And the third major thing that we're doing to prepare is that we've moved our staff in the areas that we know that we need to be prepared. We've increased our staff in the call centers, and we more than tripled the staff prepared to handle the issues as it relates to the payment system. So we believe we're prepared for what's coming in the next week. As Clyde mentioned, Saturday we're cutting over to the pharmacy system, and the next Tuesday the remainder of the system is being transferred over. Over the last year, we worked with healthcare associations, with the providers and our users. We believe we have their support for going forward. We work closely with the Oregon Managed Care Plans on a monthly basis and now on a weekly basis, and we have their support for going forward. I appreciate this opportunity to give you an overview of what the MMIS is and what issues we expect to have to manage in the coming months. Mr. Psyche and I are now open for any questions that you may have.
Questions, Representative Richardson?
No question.
Okay.
Representative
Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming and give us an overview of the MMIS system. Launch date, you said, is the 9th. Is that correct?
For pharmacy, Chair Riley, Representative Edwards, for pharmacy, it's December 6th, 9 o'clock okay. in the morning. We're doing a cutover in the evening of the 5th, coming up on the 6th, and then for the remainder of the system, Tuesday, 8 o'clock. December 9th.
Okay. So my question is, how is the project implementation gone? And I mean, through the various phases, essentially, I mean, the bottom line question is the project on time, on budget, and is the launch date what you anticipated?
The answer to that question is we've had two extensions to the implementation date. The two extensions were because we had more defects, we had more outstanding defects than we were comfortable going live. Our initial go-live date for this year was June 30th. We then moved it to September. In both cases, before making the decision to go live, the department had a project readiness assessment, which was to assess the readiness of the system, the readiness of providers and users and clients. And in those assessments, we believed that there were outstanding issues that needed to be solved before we went to implementation. So we've extended the implementation date twice, from June to September, September to December. We do believe at this time that we're ready to go forward. As far as project budget is concerned, we are within the project budget, even though we've had to do the extension.
Thanks. That's all I wanted to know.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I probably should know more about this than I do, but was this your goals, or were these goals that the federal government gave you on when your start dates were, or...
Chair Riley, Representative Beyer, we've worked very closely with the federal government, and they've been a partner because they're the major funder of the project the whole way. So goals and timelines we set always have to be cleared and approved by the federal government, as well as they are the major driver on what the system should or should not do. And so they've had a major say in the timeline, as well as what the system capacity and capability is.
So when you say that, it's that you have to clear with them any extensions, or you just work together through this whole process to get it done?
Chair Riley, Representative Beyer, we do have to clear any extensions to the timeline with the federal government, and then they've approved the two extensions that we've requested.
I'm a retired COBOL programmer. I realize I'm obsolete now, but I do have a couple of questions. One relates to you talked about error codes and that the providers needing to learn error codes. I assume these are online error codes that they're going to be getting when they submit for adjudication. Is that correct?
Chair Riley, we provide paper responses to their claims. The online responses are there also. These error codes are explanations of why the claims were not paid, what potentially is wrong with the claim, such that the provider then can make a change to the claim and resubmit it. Error codes is probably a technical word. It's an explanation of why the claim was not paid. And in some cases, there's jargon involved, and the jargon changes from claims system to payment system.
Right.
And some of the language is different, and we expect that even though we've trained a large number of providers in the different language, not everybody's been to training, and not everybody's prepared for the different messages that they're going to receive with their claim statements.
So at least they are messages as opposed to codes.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was a little concern. You know, having doctors try to learn code it bothered me. The letter that you sent to your clients, I wonder if I could get a copy of that letter. I'd like to see that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate your
testimony.
Thank you. I'm going to close this informational hearing, and I'm going to open another public informational hearing on public broadband wireless project. And if Mr. Simmons, Representative Simmons, Mr. Hansen, whoever's going to come up first. Mark,
if I may. Chair, my name is Mark Simmons. I am the State Director for Rural Development, U.S. Department of Agriculture, a former member of this august body, and I very much appreciate you taking the time today to hear about a concept that could have huge benefit to rural parts of our great state. There is a rural renaissance going on across our nation, in spite of the fact that we are having a bit of a bump in the road just lately economically. The stars have aligned to provide dramatic change to rural America. The renewable energy and our need for energy self-sufficiency is driving a tremendous amount of investment, not only in wind power that is continuing on in the Columbia River Gorge area, but technology for renewable fuels, derivatives from ethanol or cellulosic processes that will take wood chips or straw or grass straw and convert it into a fuel that we can use in our cars. That is one component of what is driving that rural renaissance. The other is broadband and the ability to transmit huge amounts of data across vast spaces and allow people in rural communities to do high-tech jobs just as easily as if they were in a cubicle in Hillsboro or Portland or where have you. And this is something I am personally very passionate about, the ability to drive economic growth, the benefits of educational resources that can become available through broadband, and just the business and the diversification of rural economies that can be driven by the availability of broadband in rural communities is tremendous. Unfortunately, the telecommunications companies, the incumbents, are just not motivated to build out the rural areas. There is much more revenue to be had from per mile of fiber that you bury in Beaverton than there is in my hometown of Elgin. When I first got online at the house out of Elgin, 3 miles out of town, I was able to get on at 24, 26K. And I complained to the phone company, and they did some adjustments and got us up to 56K. And I was excited. I called the other day. We still have my home there. And I called last night to find out, well, what's available today? If we would be considering this, I want to know how relevant this subject matter is to the current situation out there today. And still, they've got 56K dial-up available. And that, quite frankly, will not support commerce. It will not support the educational. You can't do WebEx over 56K. You can't do, you are essentially cut off from most of the rest of the world. You can get your email, but you cannot communicate and participate in the global economy or even the national or statewide economy over 56K. And we have here today an opportunity. A convergence of timing and events, if you will. My experience in politics taught me that there's a lot about timing and the lining up of the stars, and a window of opportunity opens and you can go through it or not, or at least debate whether or not to go through it. We have technology that has matured in a technology called WiMAX. It's not Wi-Fi. Chair Riley, you may be totally familiar with this. It's big pipes. I'm not a tech guy, but I know that it's 30 plus megabytes per second over 30 miles, just like a cell phone. But it's got range. It's got range and a big pipe, bigger than I get on my DSL line here in Salem, and in my house, or bigger than any of the cable companies provide if I wanted to use that kind of a service. And I believe, and the reason I'm here to advocate for this today, at least taking an objective look at this, is that if there's an opportunity to collaborate with the folks at the Owen Project, I think it's worth a look. I understand fully and fully support the need being addressed by the Owen Project. I have great admiration and respect for my friend Lindsey Ball and his ability to execute and manage and carry out a plan. And there's no thought to derail or sidetrack. But if there's an opportunity here, and you folks will have to decide, to collaborate and be able to provide, through some kind of collaboration, a huge new benefit to rural Oregonians, I think it's definitely worth a look, because there is a window of opportunity. The technology is mature. It's being deployed in other places around the world, but not here. When I was in China a few years ago, they had 3G over there, and we didn't have it here at all yet. Because of the competitive nature of how we roll out technology in the U.S. of A, and the need of the incumbents to recapture their investment. The third world countries are going directly to WiMAX in some cases. They're never building out the copper that we have invested in here in the U.S. And there's an opportunity here to consider this. The decisions that you make here do, in fact, create the future that the citizens of Oregon will live and work within down the road. And I am grateful for your willingness to hear the issue today, and would be happy to be of support in any way that I can.
So, Director Simmons, in what way do you see collaboration with Owen? How would that collaboration look?
Well, I know that Owen has a specific set of criteria and needs that they have to meet. If there's opportunity to provide an overlaying network or to collaborate with siting, I'm not the one to describe how that should look really, Chair Riley. I apologize for that. But really what I wanted to do today is emphasize the need in rural Oregon, because it is getting left behind. And although you have organizations like Clearwire partnering with Intel to build out WiMAX in some of our urban centers, It's not being contemplated in Wallowa County. It's not being contemplated in Grant County, or the rural outlying areas of a lot of the rural areas of our state. And this, we have an opportunity here potentially to to begin to extend that to areas that would not otherwise be served.
Questions?
Or just a brief
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Director Simmons, for bringing this to us today. I fully concur with the sentiment that we need to greater broadband deployment throughout Oregon. It's been on, I think we all carry a list of stuff with us to do, you know, the to-do list, and just finding out what the deployment of broadband is in rural Oregon has been on my list for a little while now, and haven't gotten around to it. But I'm a firm believer in it, and as somebody who is supported financially, I mean, my wife, her business depends on high-speed internet. 56K would not work. if we lived in a 56K world, I would not be able to afford to be doing this, what I'm doing right now, because I know my wife would not be able to do what she does. So, you know, and having family that lives in rural Oregon, I completely understand. I want to be supportive. Having said that, to the extent that any partnering with Owen would compromise the Owen project or slow them down, I don't think that they should be held accountable by this body if we put, you know, a mandate on them of some sort to work with to work with you folks in doing that. I mean, we just need to recognize that we would be giving that directive to Owen.
Well, I agree with Representative Edwards that it's very desirable to have that. I have a fiber to my house, I have six servers in my garage. So I fully appreciate where you're coming from. I can barely remember 56K in Hillsboro, but I think that we need to be very careful in, you know, attaching any new requirements on Owen. I think we have to be extremely careful of that. We have a real need to get that system up, deployed, and in service as quickly as we possibly can. And so I'm very hesitant to put any mandates or any further requirements on them. I'm obviously would like very much to see if there's some way that you can share towers, something like that. I think that would be a very reasonable approach. But beyond that, I think it's a stretch to try to burden Owen with anything other than that at this point.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Richardson.
No, I certainly agree with that this is a balance. I think that we ought to always remember that we're committing hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayers, you know, resources, mm-hmm. and that we should constantly encourage any way that we can to make sure that this is not just an emergency deployment operation, but that in whatever way that we can, that the citizens have access to utilize these facilities in a way that will benefit them when it's not an emergency condition. So that's just such a huge investment. Owen needs to be constantly reminded that we want any way possible for accessibility for, you know, other services that will be beneficial to the citizens.
Right. I agree with that, Representative Richardson. Thank you for that comment. Anything else that you want to leave us with before we go on to the next witnesses? Or?
No, I've said my piece, and I appreciate the committee's time very much.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Greg Hansen and Link Shadley, thank you for coming. And if you would each introduce yourself before you speak, and please proceed, whoever's going to go first.
Chairman Riley, members of the committee. My name is Link Shadley. I live in the Dalles, Oregon. I'm a project manager for Mid-Columbia Economic and Development District, although I'm here probably as much as a private citizen than anything. Have been a broadband advocate in Oregon for almost two decades since I moved to Astoria, and I had zero connectivity. And we finally got a couple of 2400 baud microwave channels borrowed from ODOT and had our first dial-in modem pool. And I was surprised to hear the word COBOL, Chairman. My first computer was a 363-pound electromechanical bombing computer that didn't have any transistors in it. Right. So to me, COBOL, RPG, CPM, those were new things. And technology has moved fast enough that I'm not sure I know what I'm talking about yet either. I will have to use one acronym as I go through the morning, and I understand that when I used to work for OECDD, there was a fine, so I have a donation for the committee coffee fund for using at least one acronym this morning.
Well, as long as you explain what that acronym is, we won't take your donation.
We'll try to do that several times. Seriously, in a way of explaining, and some of this will be old material to you, but we kind of need to lay a platform of how we got from way back when to what is available to us at the moment. As you're aware, the internet has grown up, and there's a lot of ways to think about it and analogies, but a spider web that pretty much covers the earth. Many ways to connect to that. My concern and our goal here is to be able to make sure that Oregon is connected as possible to that internet so that we can do commerce, education, healthcare, along with games, all of the wonderful stuff that comes with the internet. And I apologize to Representative Richardson. I presume you cannot see this, so I may be a little bit more verbose than most.
I'm listening carefully. Thanks.
Representative, there is a slideshow that he's using, so for your information. Can we get a copy of that to send
yes,
to the Representative Richardson?
Yes, Chairman.
Thank you.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
There's still a lot of areas of Oregon that do not have broadband. There are a few areas even that don't have telephones. And one milestone in my career was getting the first telephones in Cow Valley. And that's halfway between Iron and Brogenside in North Malheur County. Had no budget, no authority. We just, at the end of every presentation, showed a picture of Cow Valley, and I pointed out that there were Oregonians that had no basic phone service. They were trying to get a fire department going, an ambulance service going, and they were trying to use CB radios from mountaintops. And we just shamed enough people that finally it was Mark Simmons' organization, USDA Rural Development, and the FCC High Cost Fund came together with new owners of Oregon Telephone, and by golly, they went from nothing to fiber to the farm. Hopefully I can do that again. The solution is to provide broadband everywhere. The private sector will do a good job of providing it in urban areas. We know that. We see that. That's why you have fiber in your garage, sir. I don't. I have DSL, and I'm pretty thankful for that where I live in the Dalles. It works most of the time unless we have a BIF, a backhoe-induced fiber failure in Mosier. Once we get a redundant ring around the state, we have them in most parts of the state. The gorge does not yet. Once we get that, then the backhoe can cut it, and I don't care. Oregon has had a lot of firsts, and the United States has had a lot of firsts, and it's just good to think back that the same time the first telegraph line operated in the world, my ancestors came across the Oregon Trail and landed here, and I was born up in the Hood River Valley. And I'll go through these fairly quickly. As the internet has grown, hardware has caught up, content has caught up, and our skills have caught up. Sometimes we have to bring people kind of dragging and screaming, you know, into the 21st century and to use this technology. My sister, who's 15 years older, I will never get to touch a computer. But I have managed to keep my skills up a little bit. But we have a major digital divide in Oregon, and I don't care if it's only 5% of the people or 10% of the people. They deserve access to the same services that the rest of us get, whether we're in a small city or in a very large city. I think it's probably closer to 60 or 70% of the people don't use broadband, based on the best statistics. Probably 30% don't have access to broadband if they wanted it. Those numbers are extremely hard to come by, because the only real data that has come out has been from the FCC, and they did it by zip code and said, gee, if one person in that zip code has broadband, then we'll check that whole area off as having broadband and the population in it. And that really skewed the numbers. Made us look good on the worldwide statistics, but in actuality, where people could get broadband was, we don't really know at this point. And there'll be, I think, discussion about that later. There are a lot of people on the internet, a lot of nodes. We think about 1.4 billion people currently use the internet. And of course, the power of the internet increases exponentially with the number of users that are connected to it. One of old Moore's laws that I really like. So our vision, and I will explain what we are attempting to do here in just a moment, is to provide every Oregonian with broadband everywhere, all of the time, virtually every square foot of Oregon, with some minor exceptions for the wilderness areas, and we think we can even cover those fairly well by putting access points around the perimeter, shooting down canyons where we have rafters, hikers, campers. We sometimes get in trouble. Seems like we lose one or two people out in Maupin every year on the Deschutes simply because they can't call out for help. We're kind of excited about the new administration and their focus on technology. They understand technology. We think we'll see a shift in the way the FCC does business and some additional spectrum become available. Certainly more emphasis on using technology for access to citizens. Hopefully better use of technology for economics and business also. Some of the ground rules for any kind of a technology that we bring forward, it's got to be easy to use, it's got to be affordable, works with a variety of devices, whether it be a handheld device in your car, on your desktop, on your lap when you're sitting in bed at night. It needs to support various models. By models, whether that be gaming or e-commerce sites or government sites, deliver a broadband experience that's similar across those different models, so we don't have to learn a new skill set for every bloody device that I carry, which is one of my personal heartburns. Supports many applications, voice, video, data, obviously. I saw a smile, Representative Edwards, did you ring with that? And it needs to be global so that it works most everywhere that I go. Now, if I go to Bora Bora, which I'd love to someday, and I don't expect my cell phone to work. But I've tried to carry a cell phone for probably 12 years and been extremely frustrated. I buy a service, and one, it works in Portland and Salem, but it doesn't work in the Dalles. I buy a different one for the Dalles. It works there, but I get roaming charges in Portland. It doesn't work at all in Fossil or Mitchell. So this needs to be ubiquitous across the board. And once we can connect to the internet, whether we do that by what we have known as Wi-Fi at your coffee house or this second generation cell phones or third generation or even, I'll slow down and let the slide catch up, wireline of some sort, whether it be fiber, cable modem, DSL, and now the new kid on the block is WiMAX, and there's the buck for the acronym. WiMAX stands for Wireless Interoperability for Microwave Access, and I'll explain a little bit more about that in a moment. The technology is here, and now it's being used. There are deployments across the world. There are deployments across North America. And the why WiMAX and what it is, I carry a neat little light that I got. I love technology. This is a mag light that has an LED. This thing burns for about 12 hours this way. But when we've talked about microwave, it's been a point-to-point. You know the big dishes that shine at each other. And WiMAX is simply taking that high-frequency microwave and opening it up so that it broadcasts 360 degrees. Covers about 30 miles. And any WiMAX-enabled device that I have that can see that tower or that access point or close to it, we can then communicate over broadband and at fairly high speeds, upwards of 70 megabits per second. Probably be a long time before any of us use that.
I'm going to ask you to turn off your light, please.
That is distracting. Thank you. I'll use a candle next time. We talk a little bit about the deployments. I got behind in my slides here. We'll get through quickly. There are a number of cities, communities that are deploying WiMAX. I kind of hear more every morning in the news. The bulletins come through. And WiMAX can talk both fixed, point-to-point, also mobile, whether that be a vehicle or a handheld device. Tests in England have been done with vehicles moving at 70 miles an hour, and they still get about 10 megabits per second. So we can communicate back and forth. Our concept, going back to that light that used to be there, is instead of large towers, like you see in cell phone towers, microwave towers, is to use a smaller access point and put about 1,000 of them around Oregon. That would give us coverage border to border, California to Washington, Idaho to the Pacific Ocean. And those points would be on high points, but not necessarily mountaintops. We'd obviously pick higher topography so we get better line of sight. But simply by virtue of the number of them, we get really, really good coverage. At any point in Oregon, you would have three or four of these access points that are accessible to you. By an access point, these are kind of like a street light. They're not huge towers. Street light pole with three antennas mounted on the top of them. For the majority of the network, they would be solar powered and wind powered, so we don't have to plow cable to them. They are mesh networked, meaning they talk to each other. They form a self-healing mesh. Any one or number of those points can be knocked out or fail for some reason. Network doesn't care. It keeps working. Any place we have the poles near existing fiber, we would connect to fiber and have an entryway from the internet into this mesh network. That would be extremely reliable also. Any number of those could get knocked out for backhoes, and the system would still work. We think for the first time in history we have the technology here and now to do this kind of a broadband deployment and do it statewide. If we do it as a private business case, then yes, we've got to focus on urban areas, as we've seen the private providers do. We want to take a look at a way that we can do this statewide, border to border. We can serve everybody with the same technology. And we think we're at the point now where we can do that. We have the technology, and Greg will talk a little bit more about the business case that we're developing to make this work. Thank you, sir.
Questions? Thank you.
Chairman Riley, my name is Greg Hansen. For the record, I'm a farm boy from Nebraska who first came over the Oregon Trail in 1956, and the Oregon Trail was then called Highway 20. Our family stopped first briefly in Sweet Home and then in Albany, where I grew up, went to U of O, and I've been an Oregonian essentially ever since. Spent 12 years in Salem, including 11 years with the Salem Kaiser School District. Back in 1990, my background professionally in education and professionally and educationally is as a community educator, focusing on community development and individual improvement with the basic principles of citizen involvement, lifelong learning, interagency collaboration, identify needs, identify resources, put them together. So that's my foundation, if you will. In 1993, working with a number of folks, including then Secretary of State Phil Kiesling, the then Assistant Adjutant General Alex Bergen, and a variety of other folks, we formed the Oregon Community Learning and Information Network, better known as CLIN, or Oregon CLIN. On June 6, 1994, we put together a statewide workshop at George Fox, then college. Had teams of about, from I don't know how many communities, but there were over 500 people there, where we had then state-of-the-art technology. For example, Intel ProShare, their video conferencing solution, which they no longer have. We had this workshop with the intent of helping to raise the bar, the level of awareness for Oregonians, teams from communities, to understand what the emerging technologies and telecommunications tools were, so they could then go back in their communities and plan for moving towards the 21st century. And so that happened then, and been a variety of other activities, but Link and I first met through a rural housing project as a result of Mark Simmons and some needs with the wind energy, the turbines up in north central Oregon. So we haven't known each other since just last May. So in terms of the business case, we're two volunteers. We're self-funding this. We've talked to a lot of people. We have we're seeking additional funds, $20,000. We have an oral commitment from USDA Rural Development that was contingent upon getting the match and getting a fiscal agent. Link works for the Mid-Columbia Economic Development District. They have done other types of activities. They have agreed to be the fiscal agent. We are in the process of doing some market analysis and working with some groups, identifying the existing towers, looking at the overall topography of the state, assessing needs for consumers, and putting together business plans. So we do not have a formal business plan. And unlike other organizations, whether it's Clearwire going into Portland Metro or Owen, which had some federal funding to help with it per DHS. And by the way, we do support the Department of Homeland Security, the governor working in establishing the State Interoperability Executive Council, and Owen. So we're here to be partners in helping to move the state of the art for all Oregonians statewide. In terms of economics, Hayes works for a public agency. I've worked for public agencies. I've been involved in nonprofits. Have my own consulting firm to work for Microsoft, Intel, Jeldwin, and other companies, marketing, market research. So look at things a little differently. We've come up with what we believe is a win-win-win. This can be a self-supporting model with no state tax dollars. Again, there might be $20,000 of federal, but that's seed money to put together the business plan, the organization, and ultimately through a franchise model of putting up the 1,000 monopoles, selling or leasing those to individuals or organizations, then working with existing internet service providers, cable companies, telephone companies, cellular companies, rather than going and displace them. For example, in Central Oregon, I lived in Bend for 15 months a couple years ago. We talked to Bend Broadband, privately held. They were, this is public knowledge, they were selling the company. They put it on the auction block with the hope that Cox or Comcast would sell it. They've taken it off the auction block because of the global and the U.S. economy. Why were they selling it? Again, a 50-year-old plus started Bend Cable. They were selling because they didn't want to spend the money to invest in broadband wireless. So we've talked to them. We've reached out and said, what if you could keep your existing business, keep your existing residential and business customers, but we come in with this model and provide an enhanced level of service, and using the old Ray Kroc McDonald's model, franchising, they would pay some money up front for the franchising rights for that area. And then every dollar that comes in, say 10 cents, would come to our organization to provide for the system integration, upgrades, et cetera. They would keep the rest of the revenues locally, so we're not displacing them. In terms of this the model, again, we need to pencil it out. This is rough numbers. We think the cost of the service would be a ballpark of $30 a month. If you look at individually, and whether it's you, Representative Edwards, or everyone here, if you think about what you're paying currently for a landline at home, for your, if you have a cell phone, any type of mobile device, if you think about what you're paying currently for any type of connection to the internet, whether that's dial-up, DSL, cable, fiber, Wi-Fi, or whatever, if you add all of those things up, and you don't need to obviously share the answer, I would venture to say it's going to be more than $30 a month. So I think we can reduce for every Oregonian their potential output monthly. We think we're trying to be conservative. We think 10% of the state across the board would have an interest in this. We need to validate that. In terms of the economics, just a quick point, this slide. If you look at the four pillars of the global digital economy, it's hardware, software, connectivity, and content. As one gets a little bit bigger and better and faster and smaller, the next one needs to adjust. And so the big pipe wireless is huge. I like to call WiMAX, it's Wi-Fi on steroids. In terms of marketing, a couple quick things. We're in the process, as I mentioned, of needing to assess needs. We have some unique ideas for branding, for marketing this, in partnership with the local franchisees. Link mentioned earlier in terms of the environmental, we're going to put up monopoles. They're like telephone poles, but we've talked to the Energy Trust of Oregon, and we're in conversations with them about putting either a solar and or a wind turbine or maybe even a thermal device, so the pole is totally self-sufficient. Some will be on the grid, others won't, but for those off the grid in particular, totally self-contained. They'd have a battery of maybe a life of a month. We'd also have the partnering again with all the different facilities who already have towers and stuff. Security, whether it's for public safety, for education, for commerce, the requirements and needs for security are almost identical. and reliability. Everybody wants five nines. They want something that's never going to drop, and they don't want anybody to break in. So we will use industry strength standards per the International Telecommunications Union. Again, this is what WiMAX, the WiMAX Forum based in Beaverton, uses. Link's talked about the self-healing and all that. We will have sensors and video cameras tied to a statewide operations center, so if somebody does try and do vandalism, we have that covered. The entity, we have filed a name, Oregon Broadband, Public Broadband Wireless, that's registered with the Secretary of State's Office, Corporation Division. We're in the process of examining several different organizational structures, the pros and cons, including the possibility, again, of maybe some type of a statewide public utility or utility board. We want this to be a public entity, nonprofit, not-for-profit, or public. We've even had conversations with Steve Bass, CEO of Oregon Public Broadcasting, because in their mission it says connecting Oregonians. We think that fits, but maybe. Finally, in terms of benefits, community benefits, a couple key things. One is we are firmly convinced, if we do this right, and we will, that we will generate enough revenue to not only cover the cost of installing the towers, all of the back office stuff to make it work, but we will also have enough revenue coming in that we can share part of that. We don't know the numbers yet, but we are committed to share with either the counties, cities, school districts, or community colleges statewide, a percentage of it. Furthermore, and this ties back to the Oregon Community Learning and Information Network, we will work with schools and libraries to provide access to hardware and software for those individuals, those families, who don't have access presently, so that truly every Oregonian can have access to hardware and software.
So, what do you need from us?
It's the second time I've been asked that question this morning, Chairman. Political neutrality and probably a little bit of shielding. I anticipate there are some people who will throw battalions of lawyers and lobbyists at this idea because it will be threatening. There will come a time when they realize that this public entity is actually building out a infrastructure and a network for free that they can then use to sell services to customers. But I expect a year or two of kind of rough bumps over that. May I answer a question that you asked Mr.
Please.
Simmons earlier? And that was, how do you see us working with Owen? Hopefully fairly closely, and I see three possible scenarios. And kind of on the spectrum, we've got, you know, one, the two ends and the middle part. Scenario one would be that we do our thing totally separately. We build this out as a community network to serve the citizens, education, health care. Owen builds out to serve public safety, period. In the middle, we work a little more closely together to utilize common infrastructure, and for the actual firefighter, policeman on the line, they may have two devices. They may have a P25-type handheld radio. They may also have something that looks like a cell phone that gives them full broadband, two-way streaming video, back to a dispatch. And I think over time we will see that merge from the circuit-switched voice over to more use of a broadband device. The third scenario would be that budget issues or political issues, I would think budget issues primarily, stall the public safety network, and for whatever reason we're able to make a business case and we build out the community network. Suddenly I think you're going to find fire and police carrying around this device that gives them broadband access, and they discover they have voice over internet and they can do push to talk, and that may actually supersede. I do not want to be the person or the organization that sits here and wants to derail Owen or stop it by any means. We desperately need public safety. And kind of in a former lifetime, I was a fire chief of a small department. I really understand that. And we had horrible communications up in the Hood River Valley. But I do see a way to merge. And I think the important point this morning, the point I wanted to get across, was to inform the committee of what we're up to, lay out the technology that's available, make it very clear we're not taking pot shots at anybody, and that we're asking some fairly tough questions. And again, to sum up what Mr. Simmons said, I think we are at a very interesting point in time where we're seeing the convergence of need, the convergence of technology, the convergence of economics. That kind of brings together and point to that acronym I used, and that was WIMAX. I think that'll get replaced some future point. I don't know, that's 5 or 10 years down the road. Something new will come along. But right now, it's the best thing going. We've got it 500-some companies making products for that standard, and it works. It's cool.
So let me ask the same question again. So what is it that you want from us? I didn't really hear. I heard political neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always neutral politically, so that's nothing new. And then you went into the possible scenarios of partnering with Owen. I know Owen is open to partnering in many ways. So I'm sure you can discuss that with Lindsay and come out with something, some kind of a possible merger, some partnering of some kind. What else?
One item. We have met Mr. Simmons. Link was on the telephone. We did meet with PSC Commissioner Ray Baum. And because this could take on a utility flavor in some way, shape, or form. For example, we've had conversations with the folks who were involved when the PGE Enron situation, who were involved in proposing the Oregon Mutual Utility.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of many alternatives that we're exploring, that kind of a concept. There might be a need for legislative action of some type. So we just wanted to inform you.
Okay.
We wanted to let you know that there are other alternatives. And frankly, I think another kind of fourth alternative to what Link mentioned of the spectrum is Owen goes ahead and builds their network. We build ours totally independent. But we could put a second radio in each tower and have a redundant network that in the event, I don't know what, a redundant public safety network at no cost to the taxpayers of the state of Oregon.
I like no cost to the taxpayers. I like that. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman.
I'm going to ask Lindsay, I see you back there. I wanted to ask you if you have anything you'd like to add into this discussion at this point.
Excuse me. Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I work for Governor Kulongoski, and I'm assigned to the Owen Project. Today was the first day that I had a chance to meet the gentlemen that were testifying. I had a telephone conference with them last week and explained to them at that time that Owen is open to any type of partnership on infrastructure, that we have sites that have been identified and engineered, and as long as anything that they would do would not interfere with public safety communication, they would be invited openly on any of our facilities. And I think that would be an opportunity, because as I have said earlier, I think that as we build out the Owen system, there will be opportunities when private enterprise will see an advantage to being on the same site that we are. And they won't have to build a tower or install a building, etc. At that time, they could utilize our facilities for a leased fee. And I think that's a real opportunity and possibility here with the concept that they brought forth to you today. Now, I would say, in talking with them on the phone conference, there hasn't been any engineering done on the WIMAX system for Oregon, so there's lots of questions about what sites there would be and required sites there would be, along with a site that the state would be putting in. Would that line up with where they need to be? So there's lots of questions that need to be answered yet before we can get to that point.
So it sounds to me like when they're ready to go and any of your sites coincide with their sites, you would be willing to negotiate with them and allow them to use those sites on your towers as long as it doesn't interfere, and it would be like any other private industry, there'd be some lease agreement, that type of thing. Is that correct? Do I understand that right?
Chair Riley, I think you're spot on. You've got it just exactly the way I see it. And it's exactly what we've told other private enterprise communication industry folks.
Okay. Any questions for Lindsay? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wants to have any input on this subject at this point? Seeing none, I'm going to close this public hearing. And I'm going to open another public hearing, an informational meeting on the broadband policy report. Ono Hussing, if you'd come forward. Tell me how to pronounce your name.
Husing. But you got the Ono part.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ono Husing. I am the director of the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association, which is a nonprofit that works for the cities, the counties, the ports, the soil and water conservation districts, and the Coquel tribe on the Oregon coast. We've been around for about 30 years, and we have enjoy a very strong relationship with your colleagues on the Coastal Caucus, and I know a number of legislators. Good to see you, Representative Beyer. Today, I'm here in the capacity of representing the Oregon Telecommunications Council. I understand Representative Richardson is still on the phone.
Correct.
I'd like to extend to Representative Richardson, his constituent, John Irwin, who's the chairman of the Telecommunications Council, and to you, John's apologies that he's not feeling well. As the chairman of the, he would have liked to have delivered this report to you. As the chairman of the Oregon Telecommunications Council, I have the honor of serving in his as a replacement for him, and I am a member of the Oregon Telecommunications Council as well.
Representative Richardson, I said you were here. I assume that's correct.
Yes, I'm here, and I would have loved to have heard from John Irwin today. I've already gone through the report, and we really appreciate all that your group is doing.
Well, I know John's a very good friend of mine, representative, and he thinks very highly of you, and he's pleased to have you as his state representative. And so I'm sure continued dialogue will occur between you and him and the committee.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just get to the cut to the chase here. I'll anticipate, Mr. Chair, your question, what do you want from us? And I'm here, of course, to present the report, and the report stands on its own in terms of making the case for why Oregon needs a broadband policy, and so much of the discussion that we've just heard already about there is a digital divide. I've provided some short written testimony which states the obvious. You're on this committee. You understand it. But, Mr. Terry, do you have Fios? Is that what you're... What?
Yes.
I'm jealous. That's a... God, that must be great.
It is.
There was a fiber connection right to your...
It's terrific, yes. As soon as they opened it up, I jumped for it. We have probably 10 computers in our house, including six servers in the garage. So,
when you're on the internet, the minute you probably with Fios, the minute you hit do a keystroke, bam, that web page or whatever it is you're looking for just instantaneously, right?
That's correct. And my web pages are hosted in my garage, so. I don't have to worry.
Oh, yeah, fiber to the home or fiber to the business, fiber to the premise is the holy grail. I mean, everything we've talked about here pales in consideration to having that kind of an opportunity. And I don't think getting fiber to the home throughout rural Oregon anytime soon is realistic. But, you know, we don't need that kind of connectivity in rural Oregon to really make rural Oregonians participate fully in the global economy. So, I mean, we'd love to be there, but, you know,
I don't know anyone
realistic.
I don't know anyone who has as many computers in their home as I do. So, I think that's true. We don't really need that kind of connectivity in the whole state. But we do need some. We do need connectivity. We do need broadband.
Right.
In the whole state.
And
I agree
and
with that.
My only really takeaway message here is that please accept this report as our best effort to try to sketch out realistic steps and to create, that's the ultimate benefit to the state of Oregon to have the Oregon Telecommunications Council. It leverages the talent of some really dedicated people working in with the private sector and the private sector being on there. So the bill kind of merging the two discussions into one for the sake of brevity here. But, we've been a very effective body at bringing together the private sector and the public sector to really develop relationships and to exchange information about these issues. As I was driving here this morning, I was thinking, and I've had this conversation with Mike Dewey in the past, I said, we've really come a long way. What we don't have in the Oregon Capitol right now are these pitched battles between the public sector and the private sector. 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, there was whether municipal, there should be banning of municipal telecommunication bills and all these kinds of things. And those were unpleasant hearings and to be part of that. But we're not having that anymore. And I think that's really telling that groups like the ORTC are providing the kind of forum where we promote this kind of understanding and the annual conference, Oregon Connections Conference. It's working. It's really providing Oregon value. There's no fiscal impact. Again, what you have is a number of people that are attending these things faithfully, working with the private sector people involved. So I don't want to lose sight of that's what I'm just asking again. As you know why I'm here, I'm asking you to take the LC that would continue the council and make it a committee bill just to further that process along. But
we'll be looking at that after your report.
Okay. I got to share an anecdote. Timely anecdote. Last night in Lincoln County, I attended a meeting. I had no idea this many people would show up. There were like 120 local businesses showed up for the Small Business Development Corporation there, working with the community college. And all of these business owners were rural entrepreneurs from the Lincoln County area. And it was a presentation on web development and web marketing. And it was so much fun. We were there for about 2.5 to 3 hours. Everybody stayed. We were getting practical tips about how to use websites to effectively market their products and their businesses. They did a great job of taking three web pages from the local businesses and putting them up on the screen. And these two web experts did basically an extreme makeover kind of thing on them. It says, talked about all the good things and the bad things on the website. But what a wonderful evening. The energy and excitement in the room of these people. I need to write it up. And so, we get caught up in the different technologies, but really at the end of the day, one of the most important features of any of this is not making sure the pipes and the wires and all that's in the ground, but that people are really using it and that they have access to the expertise like we had last night to ramp up. I mean, the people that were in the room, they already get it because they got websites, but they were there to say, how can I make my website better? And the kind of conversations that were occurring and the aha moments people were having, it's just, to me, this knowledge economy is here, and it's just, there for the taking. We have part of the broadband policy program that's sketched out in the report, and of course would be further facilitated by having the council continue to work on this. There's a national debate going on, or national dialogue, I should say, about having a national broadband policy because we are falling behind other developed nations in broadband penetration. And it's kind of sad that the nation that invented the Internet is falling behind some of the other countries in the world in terms of providing broadband services to the people in those communities. And, it's tough. I'm not here to criticize the private sector at all for not providing services to these more remote areas. But that's why we need a broadband policy, and that's why several forward-looking states like Oregon is out there in the front on working these issues to think creatively about how do we have the public-private partnerships to really make the business case to do that last mile to get these technologies out there. So, I have a lot of I've spent a number of years looking at the WiMAX, for instance, very, very, very closely. Mark Simmons was here, but he'll remember back in 2006 we were working with some people to try to make a WiMAX deployment happen on the Oregon coast, and it didn't quite happen because the technology needed more time to mature. But there's so much. I think we're really closer than we believe looking at how we're seeing the technology even being deployed from the private sector, so that what the broadband policy provides is a path to further operationalize these concepts of how to make the public-private partnerships work. What I think is probably one of the most promising things that we're really intending to do is just having the knowledge. We've seen this from on the southern Oregon coast and in northern California. Our organization spearheaded a coastal telecommunications strategy, and we were able to get the grant money to have John Irwin be boots on the ground in Curry County and Del Norte County and Humboldt County and some of the groups in northern California across the border, because they don't have fiber optic route redundancy there. They're at the tail end of fiber lines, and yes, when they get cut, service goes down for hours at a time. It's really holding that region back. But 2 or 3 years ago, we managed to get some meetings going, develop some collaboration. And what I think is really one of the most promising, no-brainer things to do, and it's matched by these rural policy and these national broadband discussions elsewhere, is just going out and documenting the digital divide, where we have services, where we don't have services. Right now, we really don't know. And that's a big effort to go ahead and do that. But this kind of information is invaluable. And we know it works because we've taken that kind of information and made it available to the private sector. And it's stimulated private sector deployment. So I think those markets exist. Part of this broadband policy is, again, a supportive process with the private sector. So I'd prefer at this point, Mr. Chairman, to open it up for some Q&A and to make sure, you know, I want to know what's on your mind and the members of the committee and answer your questions, and I can talk about WiMAX some more, whatever pleases the committee.
Great. Questions? Not seeing any. I'm going to ask you to stay at the podium here.
Sure.
And I'm going to close the informational hearing. And I'm going to open a public hearing on LC 1886 for extending the sunset provision of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. And I'm going to ask you to give us a brief summary of what this LC says and why we should do this.
Well, again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the explanation is that we have an existing highly functional telecommunications council that its central role is to provide a forum at no cost to the state of Oregon. There's no fiscal impact here. Brings together really a group of remarkable people that have developed a lot of outstanding relationships over time where we have the kind of dialogue that resolves conflicts, that promotes understanding between the public and private sector, and can be the body that in effect acts as a steering committee for the development of Oregon's rural broadband policy. And so it's an invaluable institution that, frankly, only needs to be continued. The only difference, this bill in its present form, and of course if it becomes a committee bill, we'd be subject to further hearings and further testimony, and if there are amendments at that time, it could be addressed at that time, of course. We look forward to having that dialogue with others. But all it does, really, is very simple, is just continue the Oregon Telecommunications Council, and we've explicitly proposed a few additional explicit seats on the council for the private sector. People like Brant Wolf and others already participate, so that's already happening. We just want to make that others further seats at the table for people in the private sector. So it's a very simple concept, and I won't belabor the issue any more than that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I think that it's a reasonable thing that we're going to do. I like what the council's doing. And I appreciate that you are doing it. Any questions about this at this point? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on LC 1886. Representative Byer.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 1886, dated 12/2/08, be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Byer moves that LC 1886, dated 12/2/08, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Representative Richardson, anything? Okay. So hearing no discussion, is there any objection? Hearing none, the measure will be introduced as a committee bill. And That's the last thing on the agenda. Is there anything else?
Mr. Chair, the other item that I was aware of from the Coordinating Council was the possible recommendation that you consider a memorial on the broadband policy. And I don't know if the council or
please.
The resolution. And this is page 15 of the report, is the, I think, kind of the draft resolution.
Thank you. It's an omission on my part. It is a resolution, right, that it's in the appendix. It was developed late in the process of developing the broadband policy document. So thank you for being thorough
She's always thorough.
She's good. I like that. It's great, you know, because I would have walked out of here going like this, like I forgot that last
you
piece
heard
that
it from
Kathy Britton and others wanted
yep.
me to say. So thank you. That would be, again, then, a third ask is that you consider, and it's a resolution that, again, just codifies further that's the state of Oregon's, you know, desire to stay out in front on this issue. Do you have copies of it there? Or
we do. It's the last page of the report, I believe.
Okay, page 15?
Mm-hmm. And
Mr. Chair, procedurally, if the committee is interested in doing this, since you don't have a concept in front of you,
right.
you could, as a committee, you need unanimous consent to suspend the rules to essentially take a vote on whether you'd like to have it pre-session filed as a committee bill. When I receive the legislative concept, I would circulate it to committee members and receive your approval before it's actually introduced as a committee bill. The other option is you wait till session starts with the actual draft of a concept.
Any discussion about?
Or any individual could.
Or any member, obviously.
To have it drafted. And
right. That's a possibility. What's the committee's pleasure? Do we want to do this as a committee bill? Would we like to do this as a committee bill?
I think it makes sense to do it as a committee
okay.
bill, but, I mean, I don't know if we're limited to
well,
doing that right now. If someone has it drafted.
I don't believe we're limited at this point. I think I can open the work session and do that. Is that?
Mr. Chair, if you would like to go through and have it pre-session filed as a committee bill, I've got that motion available for you. Or if you'd like to wait until session starts and do it as a committee bill, that's...
Okay. First, I'm going to open a public hearing.
Okay.
Because I need a public hearing on this before we have a work session, I believe. So I'm opening a public hearing on the concept for joint resolution on Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council bill. Mr.
I'll make one further remark about, you know, I've worked in the Capitol since this coming session will be my 20th year. And I remember way back when Tony Van Fleet and some other people, when we had some resolutions when I was a staffer at the time, and what do these resolutions really do, you know? And I think the practical utility of something like this is one of the signature achievements of the Telecommunications Council was landing through the FCC, a $20 million telehealth bill
right.
or package through the FCC. And
right.
it was because Oregon is known as a leader in working these issues that helped that grant application to the FCC. It pushed it over the top because we're in the top tier of those states that people that care about these issues say, you know what, Oregon's on top of this stuff. And given the fact that we've got a number of people asking for these limited resources to service pilot, what's happening with the telehealth program is amazing to get the hospitals and clinics and the training going so we're fully using the broadband technology for medicine. All I'm saying is that's kind of, when the rubber hits the road, it's resolutions like this that enhance our leverage to get assets from foundations and from the federal government. So I offer that as why this matters. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Questions, comments? I'm going to end the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on this major introduction. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to permit a motion to accept the measure for pre-session filing with the legislative concept draft before the committee.
Pardon me, Mr. Chair, without
yes.
the legislative
concept. I'm sorry, without the legislative concept. Thank you. With only the draft that we have and no legislative concept draft. Is there any objection?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the legislative concept just explained to the committee be precessed and filed as a committee bill for introduction.
Well, first we have to suspend the rules, I believe.
She was a little quick. You didn't quite get
sorry.
Through to the
notice.
Yeah. Yeah.
No objection,
is there any objection to suspending the rules? So ordered. So now I would accept your motion.
I repeat myself, right? Mr. Chair, I move the legislative concept just explained to the committee be pre-session filed as a committee bill for introduction into the 2009 regular session.
Thank you. Representative Beyer moves that the legislative concept just explained to the committee be pre-session filed as a committee bill for introduction into the 2009 regular session. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And I'm going to end this work session and in the committee. Thank you very much, everyone, for attending, and thank you, committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.